Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to my presentation on criminal regulations by the European Union, new threats or new opportunities. First, a few words about myself. I'm an instructor in a master program for digital forensics in Tübingen, in Albstadt-Sigmaringen, and in Mannheim. And there I teach cybercrime and criminal procedure. And I also work for the University of Tübingen. Now, let me first give you a short introduction on existing current legislation by the European Union on cybercrime and on rules on how to prosecute cybercrime. And then I'll provide you with a more detailed analysis of what the European Union will likely enact in the next months, in the next years, what is to come with regard to cybercrime and cybercrime investigations. Ooh. Some technical problems, I'm sorry. I apologize for this interruption. Now, when analyzing the Europeanization of criminal law, you can distinguish five different methods of how the European Union does criminal law. And first, you have to be aware of the fact that the European Union cannot define crimes on its own. The European Union, Brussels, cannot say this is a crime, and citizens aren't prosecuted in a European Union court of law. Instead, the European Union can only influence national legislation on cybercrime and national legislation on how to prosecute cybercrime. And the first such method, and the method most commonly used in the past, is the harmonization of criminal law and, in future, of criminal procedure. The second method is convergence of criminal law or criminal procedure by soft law mechanisms, or the so-called open method of coordination. Third, the improvement of cooperation between actors in the field of criminal law and criminal investigations. Fourth, to coordinate criminal investigations. And then fifth, actually lifting criminal investigations and criminal proceedings to a true European level. And this fifth type hasn't been enacted so far. The European Union only cares about fraud against the European Union on its own. There we have European investigations, but even there we do not have criminal proceedings so far. So let's focus on the first four methods, and these are the methods the European Union actually has used in the fight against cybercrime. Regarding harmonization, well, there was a 2005 framework decision on attacks against information systems. By this framework decision, the European Union forced member states to enact criminal laws which then criminalize certain acts such as illegal access to information systems, illegal system interference, and illegal data interference. And therefore, all member states of the European Union had to transform this framework decision into their national law. And that's why we have some doubtful paragraphs in our German criminal code, for example, the so-called hacker paragraph. This is based on this European Union Council framework decision and also on the European Council of Europe Cybercrime Convention. And the European Commission considers this German implementation of this framework decision to be mostly adequate. It's quite okay, even compared to what has been done in other member states. But there is one issue the Commission wants to be fixed in Germany, and that's that computer sabotage is only a crime in Germany if their interference is with a computer system of considerable importance for a third party. So, for example, it would be computer sabotage to sabotage an ORTS system we talked about in the last 30 minutes, but it probably wouldn't be computer sabotage to merely sabotage my laptop. Now, the second method I mentioned, convergence. What's that? It's about soft law, it's about communications, it's about reports, it's about evaluations, it's about conclusions and other non-binding instruments. And the European Union is great in writing such non-binding instruments, such as council conclusions, such as some expert reports. But what can you actually do with such soft law? Well, this soft law is an excellent argument then in later discussions about policy, about politics. And soft law provides for a good basis for reflection. And let me show you one example. Back in 2008, the Council of the European Union, that's the main legislative body in the European Union besides the European Parliament, this council came to conclusions on a concerted work strategy and practical measures against cybercrime. It focuses on some things like public-private partnerships, on better training for stakeholders, and on invitations to bring forward proposals for easier mutual legal assistance. What mutual legal assistance is, I will talk about that a bit later on, but now I want to quote one thing from this instrument from early 2008. The Council invites member states to introduce mechanisms for blocking child pornography. Service providers should be encouraged to adopt these measures. What happened 1 year later in Germany? Well, all of a sudden, there was this proposal for a so-called Zugangserschwerungsgesetz to filter the internet, first by public-private partnerships between the government and internet service providers, and then by a new law. Well, there was a public outcry in Germany concerning this law, but you could already see this law being introduced 1 year earlier, and this was the place where it could best be discussed, back when there was this soft law calling for later such laws. And by the way, you probably heard it in the news, now the European Union wants all member states to enact such laws as the current German Zugangserschwerungsgesetz, and it is under discussion on the European level. Now to the third point, cooperation. And that's the true strength of the European Union, the cooperation between the member states to better prosecute cyber criminals. It focuses on criminal investigations and prosecutions, and when one member state assists another member state in prosecuting someone, it is called mutual legal assistance. That's the technical term. And typically, such transnational assistance in legal matters, for example, I want to obtain a hard disk which is located in Austria for prosecuting a criminal. Well, typically, this is based on a classical concept. Sovereign states grant legal assistance on a case-by-case basis, and you first need a judicial decision. Is this a crime both in Austria and a crime in Germany? And then it is also a political decision. The governments of both countries need to agree to grant legal assistance in this case. And for example, you need a search warrant for some prosecution of someone who lives in Malawi, well, you need the conduct in question to be a crime here and in Malawi, and both governments agree to prosecute that. Now, within Europe, the 2000 Mutual Legal Assistance Convention already allowed for a much easier process. Now you didn't need to involve governments, but only judicial actors, and this already made things like cross-border interception of telecommunications much easier. Now, nowadays, however, almost everything within the European Union is in the process of being based on the principle of mutual recognition. Principle of mutual recognition. This means that in theory, any order by any court within the European Union is binding to any other court in the Union. Let me first tell you that this is nothing uncommon. A search warrant is executed in Berlin, no matter what, if the search warrant was issued by a court in Bavaria. Now, under this European mutual recognition principle, however, a search warrant would have to be executed in Berlin, even if it was issued by a court in Poland, in Romania, in Bulgaria. And there are already a few instruments based on this principle of mutual recognition. The most known one is the European arrest warrant, which means that Germans under some circumstances may be extradited even from Germany to be prosecuted, for example, in Great Britain. But there are already two such instruments regarding the investigation and investigation phase during the phase where you need to obtain evidence. And that's the 2003 European freezing order to freeze evidence, and the 2008 European evidence warrant. However, both these instruments are considered to be only virtual because member states don't use them. They are too complicated and have too specific rules. And the old classical concept of legal assistance, well, you had to first involve the government, but other than that, there were no rules focusing on individuals, on individual rights. And these European instruments actually include provisions to focus also on the individual suspect and to protect him. And another European aspect I want to introduce you to is, within Europe, the awareness for the principle of proportionality is rising as we speak. First, within the European Union, but more importantly, within the Council of Europe and its European Court of Human Rights. And for example, we have now a common European understanding that telecommunication interception and internet interception may only be ordered for a limited duration of time, only in cases where a severe crime is presumed, only if a deletion procedure of the data obtained exists, and only if sufficient independent oversight is guaranteed. This is the theory of the European Court of Human Rights. Of course, there's a problem in actually guaranteeing this standard within all the member states. Now, let me finally talk a bit about the coordination aspect, what has been done there in the past. Well, European institutions such as Eurojust, Europol, and to a lesser extent the European Judicial Network, well, they enter the field to coordinate proceedings throughout the European Union. They decide where is it best to prosecute a criminal, where can we best obtain evidence, and of course this is also associated with certain risks. Does a prosecutor now try to prosecute someone in France if it's easier to prosecute him in France, and if it's easier to obtain evidence in Germany, let's obtain evidence in Germany. That's the so-called forum shopping problem. But still, first to the facts, these European institutions try to coordinate proceedings and also to guarantee that one suspect is only prosecuted once in one state and not first held responsible for one thing in Germany and then in Britain and then in France and so on. The so-called nebis in idem principle. Now, after this tour de force through the current legal framework within the European Union. Let me now one step forward regarding the future of European cybercrime law. And there, the European Union is at a turning point in time. A mere 6 months ago, the Lisbon Treaty entered into force, and at the same time, the European Union agreed on a new 5-year program regarding the area of freedom, security, and justice, the so-called Stockholm Program, an open and secure Europe serving and protecting the citizens. And when looking ahead, you can distinguish three cornerstones of European cybercrime law. First, the Union is increasingly aware of fundamental rights, such as the principle of proportionality and the right on privacy. For example, Commissioner Reding has already said that she is to evaluate the data retention directive in the next months. And for example, she has seen the light that this mutual recognition principle, and this is my second point, requires mutual trust. A court in Germany will only execute a search warrant by a court in Bulgaria if it trusts the Bulgarian court. And that's still some difference between the case, a court in Berlin, a court in Bavaria. Berlin and Bavaria trust each other, at least to some extent. Regarding Germany and some other member states, there is still some distrust to be seen in certain court decisions, and now the European Union attempts to alleviate this distrust and to strengthen the trust between the member states. And third, and probably most problematic, the Union recognizes a primacy of prevention. This means the Union prefers a proactive approach against crimes, and only if this fails, it will attempt to ensure the effective prosecution of crimes. There will be no safe harbors for criminals within the European Union, and there will be an increasing pressure to avert the commission of crimes, which, in the eyes of the European Union, means the utilization of internet filtering against child pornography, but possibly also against other things, and the banning of hacking tools. This must all be seen under this cornerstone primacy of prevention. Now, what is talked about regarding the harmonization of criminal law? Well, the European Union is getting more and more skeptical if this is really the best path forward. States often do criminalize things on their own, and there is hardly a need for such an European law forcing member states to update their criminal laws. Still, the Commission intends to put forward a proposal for a directive on the fight against cybercrime. I await this day by day, but up to today it hasn't been published. But probably it will focus on things like denial of service attacks, phishing, farming, identity theft. These are issues that 2005 framework decision against attacks on information systems did not focus on. But member states already criminalize these types of cybercrime I told you about, and therefore we do not need a real European reaction, and therefore this proposal for a directive on the fight against cybercrime is, in my opinion, not really needed. More interesting, in my opinion, is the already tabled proposal for a directive on combating the sexual abuse, sexual exploitation of children, and child pornography. You probably have heard about it because it includes this internet filtering provision, but it also contains some other new criminalization requirements, for example, the criminalization of child grooming, and this is not something we have to fear. This is something we really should applaud, these new criminal provisions on combating the sexual abuse of children. Now, since the Lisbon Treaty, and so only during the past 6 months, the European Union attempts to harmonize also criminal procedure. And there it focuses first on a so-called roadmap, a step-by-step approach on procedural rights. For example, if I were to be prosecuted in Spain, I wouldn't understand a word which is spoken in a Spanish court. Therefore, there will be a new European legislation on the right to interpretation and this will become a law still this year. However, the European Union also attempts to harmonize investigation techniques. And this is a more problematic provision of the aforementioned framework decision on combating child pornography. For it states that member states shall take the necessary measures to ensure that effective investigation tools are available. Quite a general clause, nothing to fear. But then it talks about allowing the possibility of covert operations, at least in those cases where the use of information and communication technology is involved. Now, what does this mean, covered operations, with regards to information systems? And of course, in Germany we had much discussions about the so-called Online-Durchsuchung, the so-called hacking of a system remotely to analyze whether some illegal data is stored on this system. And the German government is of the opinion that this new European legislation does not require Germany to enact the online Durchsuchung also in these cases and not only in terrorism cases as it is the case now. But this is something we need to focus on in the future to make sure that European Union laws do not go so far and require Germany and the other member states to provide for online Durchsuchung and similar things in other forms of crimes. Now, also in the queue is the so-called European Investigation Order or the European Evidence Warrant 2. What is this about? It's based on this principle of mutual recognition I described a bit earlier. And this now means that if a court in Portugal wants a German court and the German police to execute a search warrant, the German police will have to do so. So this is quite a far-reaching proposal, and it does not contain specific, or it does almost not contain any specific safeguards regarding any proportionality aspects, regarding any procedural aspects. And there are even some more, some other issues at stake here. The European Evidence Warrant 1, which this European Investigation Order is to replace, well, it hasn't even been implemented in Germany so far. So we do not even know if this old thing, this old European Evidence Warrant 1, is enough to properly prosecute criminals. And the European Union wants to do a so-called evidence-based criminal policy. That means first we need to be sure there is a problem, there is a need for more criminal law provisions, for more investigation techniques and so on, and only then to enact them. And this European Investigation Order is contrary to this European principle, for the European Union, or at least some member states, wish to introduce this investigation order even before we even know the European Evidence Warrant 1 is insufficient. Then, we also need to take into account the external dimension. The SWIFT agreement between the European Union and the United States regarding financial transaction data, well, the first attempt was vetoed by the European Parliament, and now there is a second agreement looming around the corner where the European Parliament, at least today, said it is quite likely to veto it again. So the European Union also attempts to ease criminal prosecutions and criminal investigations if they relate to events outside the European Union, and it enables, in this case of the SWIFT agreement, it enables the United States to better prosecute certain crimes which happened or which had effects in the European Union. And, which was hardly talked about, there are now mutual legal assistance agreements between the European Union and the United States, well, and also with Japan, but there are hardly any mutual legal assistance cases with Japan, so let's focus on the USA. This means we are getting to a stage where the mutual legal assistance also with the United States, also with certain other countries surrounding the European Union, but become much and more much more easier for prosecutors, and we will have to focus more closely on procedural guarantees also in those other states. For example, the United States, they have a completely other view on data protection, and on data protection when it relates to investigations, criminal investigations. And there we need to be sure that any cooperation agreements do not violate our European common understanding on the right on privacy and the principle of proportionality. And probably only relevant in, let's say, 5 years, the European Union now has the chance to, well, to get a new institution based on Eurojust I talked about before, and this will be the so-called European Public Prosecutor. And this new office will first focus on the fight against fraud against the European Union. But then later on, it may gain the right to also prosecute other transnational cases, for example, transnational cybercrime cases. And how will this then occur? Well, much is in doubt here, but this European Public Prosecutor would then prosecute someone under a common European penal code in national courts. And this would be a completely new concept, and it would make the European Union an even closer union. Of course, there is also a need for the guarantee of procedural rights if such true European investigations will occur in future. But what does all this mean for the open source software? Let me briefly address three major aspects: the protection of intellectual property, the primacy of prevention, and an increasing awareness for safe and secure software. First, the protection of intellectual property. The European Union strongly emphasizes the value of intellectual property and acknowledges a need for its protection. But this is something at least large parts of the open source community agree upon. If companies sell products which use modified GPL licensed software, the open source community is forcefully protecting their own copyrights. The whole concept of the GPL and other similar software licenses is based on the principle that you can copyright and protect your intellectual property of the copyrights, and open source software actually needs a protection of intellectual property. A distinct point, of course, relates to the field of software patents and the enforcement of such software patents also by means of criminal law. Much has been talked about this issue already, and much will probably be talked about in future. But let me just point out one aspect. Part of the issue with software patents might be the overly long protection period, about 20 years. And this is something which simply does not fit to the fast evolving and cheap development model regarding software. It might fit to something like pharmacies and so on, but it does not fit to software. And yet another controversial aspect relates to digital rights management, or more pointedly, criminal law provisions against the circumvention of intellectual property protection. And this was something which was much feared when the so-called hacker paragraph 202C German Penal Code was introduced, but it turned out to be not so much a threat in practice, and further criminalization does not seem to loom around the corner. So the focus where the open source community needs to speak up, in my opinion, is regarding software patents, which do not fit to software, at least in their current form. If it were only protected for, let's say 3 years, I think it wouldn't be as much an issue as it is now. The second point, primacy of prevention. Regarding cybercrime, there is a need for a better training of the police with regard to the internet, that the police and also the lawyers, the judges, finally understand what the internet is about, both technically and and the social aspects of the internet, the political aspects of the internet. And there are calls for hundreds, if not thousands, of new police officers specifically addressing crimes committed by means of the internet. And, well, this is a job opportunity for at least some of us, but also, let's be aware of the fact that these new police officers typically will focus on high-level crimes, on fraud, on identity thefts, and not necessarily on low-key infringements of intellectual property, even though it's a bad thing to do, of course. And the third aspect of prevention is the need for hardened software and hardened hardware. Safe and secure software, which is not exploitable, which warns users on unsafe actions, is one of the best methods there is to protect against cybercrime. And this security of software is one of the best things and best aspects of open source. It's one of the best strengths of open source. And this strength should be much use of under the primacy of prevention. And my last point regarding awareness, citizens are also more aware than ever for the need on software which focuses on security, reliability, and anonymity, as well as data protection. More than ever, they seem to be willing to try out open source software, for it promises to provide and honor these values more than any other commercial software. So, to summarize, while there are indeed many risks associated with the Europeanization of cybercrime law, the safeguards, such as the principle of proportionality, are evolving too. And using and writing good software is one of the best safeguards there are. Thank you very much. I think we still have a few minutes left for questions, so if there are any, please stand up and ask. Otherwise, I will be available in front of the door for further discussions. Then let me thank you again and see, let me invite you as the last aspect to a second talk. On Saturday morning, I'll talk about hacking the Linux kernel, the PCMSA subsystem. Something I do in my spare time while focusing on cybercrime is my day job. Thank you.